From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards, and this podcast, Authors on Fire, now heard on our very own Firebird Radio at firebirdradio.com. I am Pat Rulo, and today I have a recent Firebird Book Award winner to share with you, Anna Abra Laster, and we are going to delve into her winning memoir, Property of the Revolution, From a Cuban Barrio to New Hampshire Milltown. When Anna was five, her family emigrated from Cuba to the United States in 1967. And ever since, she has been striving to honor her family's story and Cuban-American culture through storytelling. There's so much to talk about today, so I really want to get rolling. Welcome to Authors on Fire, Anna.
Thank you so much, Pat. It's fun to be here.
It's fun to have you here, too. Congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Award.
Oh, my goodness. That was such a nice surprise. Thank you.
Oh, well, I was happy to share that with you. All right, my friend, we have got loads to talk about today. So I just want to dig in and go for it here. So I briefly mentioned that you emigrated from Cuba to the United States in 1967. I don't want to go too far back into your past because I'm sure we're going to get all of that into the book. But as far as writing this memoir, when and why did you know that you had to write this book?
So I was just talking with someone about that this morning, as a matter of fact, telling them that I was going to be speaking with you and that I knew that this question would come up. And I realized that I knew when I was 5 years old, when I was right, one of the first memories I have here in the United States was being in that home, the first home that we had, because we were homeless when we first came as refugees. That in and of itself is its own story, but we were in that first home. And one of the ways that I kept my grandmother, who was grieving because she knew she'd never see her brother or her father again, was drawing maps of the barrio, of the streets. And as I drew those streets one day, my mother said, you know, maybe you'll write a book about all of this. Mm-hmm. And I remember that moment. And it's one of those things that just gets into your soul. Mm-hmm. And even when I wasn't aware of it being there, when I became aware, I realized it had always been there. So, and I wrote it because I know it's a unique and yet universal story of losing everything you've ever had and loved overnight and having to rebuild your life in a strange land. I mean, that's the story of human beings.
Right. When I was thinking about you as a little five-year-old, maybe describe your emotions and the experiences when your family first arrived in New Hampshire. And were there any very specific challenging aspects of this transition?
Well, the climate in Cuba, when it's a little cold, and by a little cold, it might be in the mid-60s, you get your coat. And your coat is just a sweater. But for Cubans, that's a coat. And so imagine we arrived in December, and within a few days, there was an 18-inch blizzard that dropped, you know, ice and snow. And we thought, I remember that first blizzard, and it was some of those drifts that climb up the wall of the house over the course of the day. And I'm sure my grandmother thought we would all perish. So the climate itself, but everything, we didn't understand heaters. We didn't understand furnaces or how to dress for the cold. My grandmother would pour hot water on the steps thinking that she'd be melting the ice, but she was just creating more ice.
It.
My parents, when they weren't working at the factory at the very beginning, they would shovel out the backyard of snow so that we had a place to play. They didn't understand that, you know, kids played on top of the snow in the United States. So many things, many things, the basic things, the language, the, you know, the culture, all kinds of strange introductions to this new culture, which is in so many ways so different than Latino culture. For example, almost right away, this came up. I was invited to a sleepover. Well, a sleepover at that time, especially for a Latino family, was just the most foreign thing in the world. Why would the Americans send their child to a stranger's home to sleep when the child has his own bed right here? And that just didn't make any sense. They were baffled. The concept of privacy in general in a Latino home is not that important, in fact, or even independence isn't highly valued. In fact, one of the things that people say to someone who's being kind of selfish is, "Tú eres muy independiente." You're very independent. And yet, in American culture, independence is the bedrock of everything. We want to be independent. We want to fend for ourselves. So those are some of the things.
Yeah. Wow. I think sleepovers are kind of a strange idea myself. I never did one when I was young. It just felt too weird to me. I'm like, no.
Yeah, you would. Yeah. Well, it's good for you that you knew.
I did know. It's funny.
I longed to be able to stay overnight. The closest I ever came was I could go, I could put on my pajamas, but then my mother would come at 10:30 and pick me up.
Oh, I'd have to go home. Good for your mom. I would probably do that too. My kids didn't go to sleepovers either. So that's funny. So your memoir highlights the strong influence of your Cuban heritage. How did your family maintain there in your cultural identity while adapting to this new life in a new country?
Well, it was really important to them. Now, remember, we grew up Cuban style, even though we were in New Hampshire at a time when there were almost no Latino families anywhere in sight. It was very different from the experience my cousins had growing up in Miami, for example. So it was my mother, my grandmother, her mother, my aunt, my mother's sister. So it was the mother and two sisters, the two sisters' husbands, the children of both families, and everybody in the same house at the beginning, and then eventually in a duplex. And that's how we grew up. So I had three mothers, two fathers. Officially, I had a brother and a sister, but I had two cousins who were like brothers. So we were a family of five kids, three mothers and two fathers. And all of that was very normal to me. I think that they were very, very proud, the viejos, the old people that I taught, really, this is dedicated to them, and especially to my grandmother, who gave up everything to take care of us and to come with us. Our lives would have been very, very different without her at home to care for us when all the adults were working. But the main thing was to hang on to language. And so there was a rule that you could only speak Spanish. You could only speak English to your siblings. When you spoke to an adult, you had to speak Spanish, and you couldn't mix English and Spanish.
Oh, wow.
And so that's how we all grew up fluent, including my sister who was born here. And they did it, I think, for my grandmother's sake, so that my grandmother wouldn't be even more isolated within the home. But I think it was their way of holding on to what they had lost. Because, you know, the refugee versus immigrant experience is different. Usually an immigrant wants chooses to emigrate from home, immigrate to a new land, hoping for a better life. In the refugee experience, it's usually very abrupt and it's not willingly. It's at great cost and often knowing you'll never go back. So I think my parents and my aunt and uncle and my grandmother decided they would create their own Cuba. And what the main thing was that language and keeping that language alive. And of course, music. And it was very difficult then because there wasn't any Spanish TV. There were no Spanish language newspapers or magazines. We were really isolated. So we, in fact, we were so isolated that sometimes when we would go to Miami in later years, they would chuckle because the family there, because we used expressions from the 60s. So because we were in a little time capsule and the language didn't change the same way it had changed, you know, in Miami or in Cuba. So I don't know if I answered that. I think
yes.
I did.
Oh my gosh. And so I love that multi-language within the home. And you talked about learning English through shows like Gilligan's Island.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Such a creative approach. How did you find that that experience shaped your understanding of American culture?
Well, to me, it was just so glamorous. One, you could, you know, a deserted island. Gilligan's, I mean, I wanted so much to be there. I thought there might be a place like that in the United States. I just wanted to be there with those people. And then the, you know, we called Star Trek Los Orejones. Oreja is ear in Spanish. So Los Orejones were the big-eared ones because of Spock. So we would say, oh, es la hora de los orejones. And we'd all run to the TV to watch Los Orejones, which was Star Trek. Nobody could say Star Trek. So it was just fascinating. Everything was fascinating. Everything was new, especially as a child. Yet there was a lot of grief in that home and shock, you know. In the United States, we're used to picking up and moving, you know, across the country because there's a new job opportunity. And you'll come back to your family at Thanksgiving and Christmas or whenever you can. But in Latino culture, especially at that time, you stayed with your family. When you got married, you often brought the elders with you, or you moved in with your spouse into the family home. So no one in the family had ever imagined leaving the barrio or the four generations of family we left behind. And so they were in shock but forging forward because there was no choice.
I'm thinking about you now as an adult. And so as you recount your journey and later reflect on your experiences, how did you come to terms with the psychological trauma of displacement, especially in relation to your daughter reaching the age that you fled Cuba?
That discovery is kind of what reawakened my dream to write the book.
Okay.
I had buried many, many of the memories of the events of that time, of the end of one world and the beginning, the crashing into a new world. I had buried a lot of that. And the story in my head was the story we told each other all the time, like our new origin story as a family. We beat Castro. We won. We are superheroes. Look at us go. And forward march. So when my daughter was, and we all, you know, all of us got college educations, we've all been successful in our fields. And then when my daughter was 6 years old, five, almost six, and she was about to head off to kindergarten, I got very melancholy and I'm worried that she might not be ready for kindergarten. I brought her for an evaluation, and the child psychiatrist said she is, you know, after the examination, she's fine. But I'd like to understand what your concerns are more. And she wanted to see Andy and me, my husband and I. And I thought, oh, these people just won't let you go. You know, I got the answer I wanted. What does she want with me? And she said, you know, I want to know. I want to understand what it is that you're so worried about. And I said, well, you know, kids at that age and life at that age, the world. And then I just broke down in hysterics. And I'm not a crier. I should be, because it would probably be better for me. And then she passed me the, I mean, these were, Pat, these were really hard sobs. A way, I don't think I've ever, well, when my mother died, I cried like that. But she handed me the Kleenex and she said, I think that this has something to do with the trauma you experienced when you were your daughter's age. And I just looked at her and I said, what trauma are you talking about? What are you, and she explained, she said, when I took your history, you talked to me about that last day in your home in Cuba and how the guard came and kicked you out of the house and they sealed up the house and 24, 48 hours later, you were on a plane and never saw those people again. And that's trauma. And I said, no, you know, because I just could not wrap my head around it, because how could we be who we thought we were if that was true? I just wouldn't accept it. And so, but then I had no choice because that door had been opened. And then all of these memories started to come back and I started to write. And as I wrote, I remembered all the stuff that we went through, the emotions that I had really tucked away, things that happened that I had never, that I had no memory of until I started writing. You know, and I realized how difficult all of that had been. And I just started thinking about why didn't we know this? Why didn't we look at this? And this is what is considered, I guess, in I don't know, psychological circles, you know, this intergenerational trauma, a whole family. But fortunately, we stayed together and we had each other, very close family, and remained so. But it was a very forward-looking family, and everyone, you know, dealt with these things in their own way. And I was lucky that when I recovered those memories, I could talk to my parents, and my grandmother was still alive. So I was able to get all kinds of information because they were more than willing to talk about it. They just had set it aside because there was work to do.
Before we even went on the air, we kind of slightly touched on that notion that the journey of refugeedom never really truly ends. You might not have been able to face it at that point in time because you probably couldn't have gotten through it. So as you get older, you look back on it, and luckily somebody brought that to your attention. It also makes me think about parenting across cultures and how your experiences as a Cuban refugee influenced your own parenting style. You know, here you are worried about your daughter that really had nothing to do with your daughter and more to do with you. But I assume that all that you went through really affected your parenting style and the values that you strive to instill in your children.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Family is everything. My kids, you know, have seen me and my siblings put everything aside for our family when the need has arisen. In a way that I think is different. I had a hard time. I became very depressed when I had Natalia, our first child, because I realized that I was going to be a parent in a setting that very foreign to me. I was the only mother in the house. I didn't know what I was doing. There was only one dad in the house. He didn't know what was happening. There was nobody, and I had Natalia in October. Here in New England, you're going deep into the tunnel in October. And it was just me and this little baby. Whoa. And I was terrified and very alone, but I was, you know, there's a saying in the book that comes up again and again, ponte guapa, make yourself brave. And that's a saying that my mother used to say. And we did, you made yourself brave and you kept going, but it was a very hard reality to confront. And then finally, you know, over time, like, well, it's not going to be the same. Of course, it can't be the same. They'll be there one state over, and we'll see them every Sunday. And every weekend we did see them. So because the Hunt Street was where we lived in that yellow duplex. And that house, because of the number of people and the number of friends, and it was central to all of these people, there was always something happening there on a weekend. On a Sunday, it was somebody's birthday, somebody's graduation, somebody's christening. So the house was just a riot of activity and fun. And my father raised canaries in the basement, and my mother had Cuban music playing, and my grandmother had a pressure cooker boiling with, you know, the latest, you know, ropa vieja dish that she was about to serve. And then there were little Americans everywhere, you know, because they would infiltrate and get lost in the shuffle, and dogs and cats. And so you could go back to that. And my husband said to me once, when we were leaving, he said, you are happy in a different way when you're there. It's like a soulful happiness. And it's because it's returning to the culture and to your home. Your culture is your home. You can't even get away from it, you know?
Oh, that's just such a beautiful picture you painted of that you want to have, you know, where you've got the family and the power of the women in your life. And it's something to be treasured. I wonder, as you reflect on your homeland of Cuba and your life in Cuba and the memories of your life there, how does it shape your perspective on current events in Cuba today?
Oh, well, I'm very much involved with the situation in Cuba. I have a Substack that I put out every Thursday. I stayed up last night till 4 a.m. finishing it because it's due in the morning. And it's about human rights and the political prisoner situation in Cuba. It's a 66-year-old dictatorship that says in the first page of the Constitution, it's an irrevocable system. And it is, the socialist system is to be defended at all cost with arms if necessary. And there's no change. And the Cuban people are clearly asking for political change. And the regime doesn't want to give it, doesn't want to give up power, doesn't want to introduce the democratic changes that people are in jail for advocating for. And so I watch it, and my heart breaks for especially the women, because the women end up holding the bag as always in these situations. They've got to figure out how they're going to put food on the table, what to do in a heat wave when the electricity has been turned off for, you know, that because they're rolling blackouts for 48 hours, and the baby is covered with mosquito bites because there's no fan that you can run. There's no electricity, so there's no pump to get water into the house. The food that you stood in line to get yesterday and put in the refrigerator has now spoiled. Your child is hungry. Your husband's depressed. There's no future. Your son just left because there's no future there, and he's on a raft or traipsing through Central America, hoping the border has a hole in it that he can go through. So it's an awful situation. A lot of people in the United States, pockets of people, have still such high regard for the Cuban Revolution, and they won't shift their point of view. They won't listen to the Cuban people. They listen to the regime, because they want the regime, the revolution, to succeed, and they do everything they can. And just like the regime, they blame the embargo, the partial U.S. embargo, for the hardship in Cuba. And no Cuban in Cuba or outside of Cuba believes that. Food and medicine aren't included in the embargo. The United States is one of the main providers of food in Cuba, and American farmers export to Cuba constantly. There's medical equipment that's exported there. So I got into the economy, which kind of messes things up, but change is desperately needed. People are seriously suffering, and I'm trying to do my bit by telling their stories and making sure, because it's never in the press here. You know,
No.
we've got our own problems,
Our own
obviously.
mess, yes.
But, you know, what's happening in Cuba is tied, very tied to what's happening on our border, or has been happening, because Cuba is a dictatorship, Venezuela, Nicaragua. Those are the sources of a large percentage of the people who've been at the border. They're
Right.
fleeing.
Right.
And that also has an impact on how elections go, because all of those Latinos, when they come in here and then they settle in, they're fearful that this country will turn into a dictatorship or into a leftist dictatorship. That's the issue. They're worried about communism.
Yep.
And so they vote a certain way. And it's very tied, I think, to where we are here. But somehow the connections aren't discussed. I don't know. Do you see it anywhere?
No,
I do.
I don't. Absolutely. And that's where you come in, and people like yourself that could, very individual way, make this known and get it out there. And, you know, your Substack and this book. And that leads me to the question, if readers take away one message or insight from your book, Property of the Revolution, what do you want that to be?
Believe in the power of family. Believe in the best of America and in the best of yourself. And you can go through horrible things and come out on top. You can do that. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's tough. That's a good question. And I think you have to read the book and take away your
Take
own.
What you, exactly.
Yeah, I think you would be very inspired by the story. And I think the country needs a reminder of really, all, except for Native Americans, what all of our families, to some degree, one degree or another, have gone through.
Have gone through. Mm-hmm.
And
You're right. All families have a history. It may be not us, but our, you know, past generations have certainly had their hardships to make their way and make our life better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those things bind us to each other. It's a common thread through all of our lives and in all of our histories. And that's who we are. We are a country of immigrants and of others, and that's our superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't forget that. And
yeah.
And that superpower comes from these stories.
Well, speaking of stories, any plans for future writing projects?
Well, I'm pretty busy with articles and the Substack, and I have about 30,000 words of a novel, which takes place in Cuba and here in the United States. It's two cousins trying to help each other during these protests that have been happening over the last few years. And one of the cousin in Havana, gets in trouble, and the cousin here tries to help. And they're 17, and, you know, 17, nobody fears anything when they're 17. So they both get into some pretty hairy situations.
Well, we can look forward to that, right?
Yeah. I think it'll get done.
It will get done. I can tell you will get the job done. So as we begin to wrap up, anything we missed that you wanted to highlight?
You know, I speak with high school students a fair amount, and I always tell them, talk to your parents about what they remember about their grandparents, their great grandparents, if they were lucky enough. There is so much wealth and beauty in family stories, and they really help us and they ground us, and we need them. But the pace of life especially now, and the physical distance that many of us have between us and our relatives keeps us apart, and it's a whole other world that's yours. That's your inheritance. And I know that in some cases it's not a happy place to go, and I'm not saying that one should dwell there, but maybe even so. I mean, look what happened to me. It was pretty hairy for me when I was going through this and remembering everything that I didn't want to remember, but I am more complete. And I think that that's I believe most people, even when they confront something like a dark past, if they can get through it and learn from it, it completes us a little bit, helps put things together.
Right. Not always easy, but your story is a message of resilience and hope. So,
I think so.
Yeah. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
Oh, really? There's just so much more of a conversation I want to have here. But I think we've given a little brief idea of who you are, what the book is about. So if you would, give us your contact information where folks can find out more about you, get copies of your books. Just take us where we need to go.
Yes. My website is being refreshed right now, but the old one is still up under anacubana.com, A-N-A-C-U-B as in boy, A-N-A.com, anacubana.com. And there will be links to the book and where to buy it, but you can pre-order it right now on your favorite online retailer. You can go to a bookstore and order it. It's now available for order at bookstores. It's you can ask for it at the library. Basically, the distribution is broad in the United States. It's not else international, but I'm looking forward to having this translated.
Ah, yes, absolutely.
And,
I think that's important.
Yeah, and I have an author page on Facebook, but most of my activity, unfortunately, I haven't really moved over there, is in my personal page. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn by my name. And mostly, though, my activity is through Substack. The newsletter is called Cuba Curious, and it comes out every Thursday, and it goes right into your email. So please go and sign up.
Yes, absolutely. I am going to as well. So we are talking to Anna Abeda Plaster, and the book is titled Property of the Revolution, From a Cuban Barrio to a New Hampshire Mill Town. The website is anacubana.com, and I encourage everyone to head over there, get copies of the book, sign up for your Substack. This has been a wealth of information and so heartfelt. It's going to resonate with our listeners. So I appreciate you taking the time to share it with us, and I am looking forward to your next book as well.
Thank you, Pat. It's been a pleasure. I'm so happy to have met you and to have been able to talk with you today and your listeners. Thanks for giving me the time.